Good morning, honorable members, the PG and the department, and our guests. I've been delegated by the chairperson. The chairperson is still at a strategy meeting across, but she requested that I open up the meeting so that we will start deliberating. She will join us within 10 minutes of our time. If you agree, I would also like to apologize on behalf of the minister. The minister is going to join us at 11, but the presentation is one. It's not that he's got his own presentation, but he's just going to summarize what the DG has presented to us. With those words, I would like to welcome everybody. This is our meeting, and we expect everybody to contribute. I would like to hand over to the committee secretary to give us the written apologies. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Ntuli. I have two apologies. One from Honorable Holomisa, who's not available today, and Honorable Ngonyama. Those are two apologies.
Those are the apologies, and can we just do for the benefit of those who are coming for the first time here, just quickly, I'm Chris Ntuli, the whip of this committee, who has been delegated to chair this meeting.
Naren Singh, member of this committee. Chair, as I indicated earlier, I'd like to be excused just to go to an auditor general briefing and come back.
I'm Pierre Ravi. I'm also a member of this committee.
Kubis Mare, member of the committee.
I'm Kai Kwabe. I'm visiting for the first time today.
Richard Levine, EDD.
Richard Mantonda, Head of Green Industries, IDC.
Economic Development.
Thank you very much. And I hope we'll... is everybody got the agenda? I'm the only one. Because the item number 3 is briefing from the EDD on green economy and jobs. Then thereafter, the discussions and questions will follow, and then we'll have tea. Then we'll take the ideas. I think the minister will have arrived at that time. So we'll try to stick on this agenda as we proceed. So I would like to hand you over the two members who are coming. It's Honorable D.R. Tsotsitsi and ex Mabasa is still on the door. They'll be joining us. I'll hand over to you, Tichi, to take us through. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honorable Members. Basically, what we decided to do was to integrate the presentation. So we have one presentation which is prepared by
EDP and IDC jointly. We felt that would give a more comprehensive overview and approach to the issues of the green economy. So that's the way we've approached that, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. And basically what we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at very briefly the policy basis for greening the economy, and just touching very briefly on the new growth path and IPAP 2. We're going to look at some of the initiatives, again in an overview format, which the IDC has taken with respect to the green economy. We're going to be looking at some of the key government priority areas and the work which the IDC is doing in these areas, solar water heaters, biofuels, and the renewable energy program. We'll just touch very briefly on some of the key issues around the COP, and then we'll just look at a list of the top 10 projects that will be exhibited in terms of the climate change and response exhibition at the COP 17 in Durban at the end of the month. Just running very briefly through some of the highlights of the green economy in the new growth path. As we know, the new growth path targets 300,000 additional direct jobs by 2020 to green the economy, with 80,000 in manufacturing and the rest in construction operations and maintenance of environmentally friendly infrastructure. Additional jobs will also be created by expanding the existing public employment schemes to protect the environment as well as in production of biofuels. And the IRP2 targets for renewable energy also provide new opportunities for investment and employment in manufacturing, new energy technologies, as well as in construction. So the main strategies in order to achieve these targets are comprehensive support for energy efficiency and renewable energy as required by the IRP2, including appropriate pricing policies combined with programs to encourage local production of inputs. And solar water heaters will essentially commence the process. And then public employment and recycling schemes geared to greening the economy, stronger programs, institutions, and systems to diffuse new technologies to small and medium enterprises as well as households, and greater support for research and development and tertiary education, which is linked to the growth potential and developing South Africa as a higher education hub for the continent. And then continuing to reduce the cost of and improve access to broadband. In terms of IPAP 2, there's a number of key sectors that have been identified, which include wind power generation, photovoltaic power generation, concentrated solar power generation, water efficiency, waste management, energy efficient vehicles, and so on. And then there's key action programs within the sectors, which include the rollout of a national solar water heating program, solar and wind energy, the development of an industrial energy efficiency program, strengthening water efficiency standards, and demonstrating the viability of concentrated solar thermal power as a major renewable energy generation source. Clean and multi-energy stoves, waste and wastewater treatment, and the South African Renewables Initiative. Now, this slide just shows how the IDC has aligned its sectoral focus areas with the New Growth Path and IPAP 2. And basically, so we see the different jobs drivers here, agricultural value chain, manufacturing activities, tourism and creative industries, and so on. But there's also an indication that in terms of the green economy, it's green energy-saving industries and biofuels, as well as green industry components for the green economy. So this basically is what this slide captures. And if you look at the growing role which the IDC is playing in the green economy, the investments would include in the areas of clean production, clean energy, energy efficiency, demand-side management interventions, emission and pollution mitigation, waste reduction, and biofuel. And the approach is a value chain approach with emphasis on industrial development, including localization and job creation. This sort of illustrates that in slightly more detail and gives a breakdown in terms of the different energies, renewable energy, non-fuel power, including wind power generation, concentrated solar power, solar photovoltaic power, and then in terms of energy efficiency, heat, electricity, and building efficiency, cleaner production, transport efficiency, and then fuel-based energy in terms of waste-to-energy, cogeneration, biofuels, bioethanol, biodiesel, and emission and pollution mitigation, air pollution, water and treatment, waste management, recycling, and clean stoves. In terms of the funding arrangements, with an emphasis on innovation in the area of energy efficiency, the IDC has created an enabling environment by securing cheaper funding with long debt tenures to act as a catalyst in the energy efficiency markets. The Green Energy Efficiency Fund was launched recently, and this offers market debt at concessionary rates with debt tenures up to 15 years by partnering with the German KfW, which is a development finance institution. And these loans have been structured in terms of allowing repayments to effectively match the savings profile of the technology installed. So on a rooftop photovoltaic, the savings over 15 years are equivalent to the debt service repayment, and hence a 15-year facility is proposed, so it doesn't become or becomes an out-of-pocket expense for the company concerned. This kind of just elaborates on the funding arrangements, the Green Energy Fund, the different components, the KfW concessional debt funding and the technical assistance grant, and the IDC's reduced interest loan, prime less 2%, with a long-term payment up to 15 years to stimulate energy efficiency and renewable energy investment. A technical assistance component to identify energy efficiency and renewable energy opportunities, calculating the economic and financial benefits, and supporting the selection of eligible equipment and enhanced performance technology. Promoting long-term business competitiveness through modernization of businesses, increased company profitability, improved product quality and product production capacity, and lower vulnerability to increasing the energy prices. And then in terms of the contribution to global climate protection through measurement of energy savings and carbon reduction, as well as enhanced company image due to the contribution to the reduction of the carbon footprint. In terms of the priority areas that government has identified, currently there's sort of three broad areas of priority, and those are the solar water heaters, biofuels, and the renewable energy independent power producers procurement process. The key objectives of the solar water heaters is to scale up the financial support in order to achieve the target of 1 million solar water heaters installed by 2014-15 and increased local production of components. Now, obviously, there's several benefits through implementing the solar water heater rollout. And this would include reducing electricity demand, providing universal access to modern, affordable, environmentally beneficial solar water heater services for all households in South Africa on an equitable basis. And we'll sort of elaborate on this to see how this is going to be achieved. Then offsetting the rising electricity costs to residential households, accelerating water heating service delivery, particularly to low-income and indigent households, and then achieving renewable energy targets contained in the white paper on renewable energy, and contributing to the mitigation strategy of the country for climate change, and then creating a competitive and sustainable local solar water heater equipment manufacturing and installation maintenance base in South Africa, creating sustainable livelihoods and correcting the energy mix, moving from water heating through electricity to a renewable energy source. This is being implemented by a interdepartmental and which includes SOEs and DFIs process. There's a project steering committee that has been established, which has been looking at how we can achieve some of the key objectives that we referred to in the course of this presentation, which are in line with the new growth path. And those include localization, getting an even or equitable provincial distribution, getting youth employment, looking at the funding, which is obviously the key challenge around this particular rollout, looking at amendments to the regulatory environment, and dealing with the vexing question of guarantees for installed solar heaters in case installers go out of business. And then also looking at set-aside for cooperatives in terms of installation in particular. Now, basically, there are two technologies, low-pressure systems and high-pressure systems. The low-pressure systems are the lower-cost systems where we do have an opportunity of a mass rollout for low-income houses. And we're looking at utilization of a contractual model through some form of grant funding from the fiscus. And then high-pressure systems, which are driven by a demand-side management agenda and looking at a standard offer program employed by the Department of Energy. Now, if we're able to implement this contracting model in the mass rollout of low-pressure systems, we are going to be able to achieve economies of scale and stimulate localization and investment interest. We're also looking at awareness and the creation of demand, because this is one of the key issues with the uptake of solar water heaters is creating demand in the economy. I think one of the things we always like saying is when we sit in a room like this, how many of us have actually installed solar water heaters in our own homes or dwellings? And the issue is obviously the price of the solar water heater. So we need to try and stimulate demand. And the kind of mass rollout of low-pressure systems will not necessarily deal with the demand side of things fully, but it certainly will create a greater awareness. And I think creating awareness is very much part of the agenda of this program. We also need to ensure that we achieve equitable distribution across the provinces, because the current rollout which has achieved almost 200,000 visas. There's very sort of inequitable distribution across the provinces. And we want to try and ensure that we have a more equitable distribution. We're also looking at the training opportunities because we need more qualified plumbers than we currently have to support the rollout plan. And we're also looking at the issue of project finance, leverage from the private sector, including insurance and the banking sector, particularly in the high-pressure rollout. And then the contract process will also achieve some of the socio-economic objectives because through that contracting model and the specifications for those contracts and the tenders which will lead to the securing of those contracts, issues around employment, particularly youth employment, can be built into those, as well as set-asides, localization requirements. And we are sort of exploring the possibility with the DTI of designation in this particular area for the mass rollout of the low pressure system. There is already an example of a project supported by the IDC where we have a programmatic clean development mechanism project which will be registered worldwide at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this is the first low-pressure solar water heater programmatic rollout where we have created more than 500 jobs for the unemployed in these hitherto impoverished areas, and supporting livelihood creation in those areas, but also providing running hot tap water for the first time in these particular areas. So I think this just gives an illustration of what could be achieved if we can achieve the mass rollout of the low pressure system.
Sorry, teacher.
I
would like to hand over to the chairperson. As I've said, that she requested that I open up the meeting. I want to brief the chairperson to say we don't have many presentations. It's one. It means then the IPC, the minister, but although you know that the minister will be coming at 11, but the presentation is one, so that you are with us. I would like to hand over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I thought that would be done after the DG has presented. Yeah, the report, in terms of the report, the DG had already briefed me yesterday on the joint report. And I'm happy that you did announce that the minister will be later. I hope that you also put my apology. I started in another meeting. Okay. Thank you. Hand over back to DG. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Well, as indicated, there's these three priority areas that we're talking to in terms of government priorities. So the first one was the solar water heaters, which I've given an overview of that process. And now we're going to look at biofuels. And this slide just depicts the bioethanol value chain from the agricultural production of the feedstocks through the logistics and plants to the primary product, which is ethanol for petrol blending at a refinery or depot, also the main byproducts and the possible value add. And basically this rollout aims to facilitate job creation and rural development. And we do have a project which is currently being piloted in partnership with the IDC, where phase one involves 6,000 hectares of grain, sorghum, and sugar beet production. Also in partnership with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. And we're looking at the creation of around 2,000 jobs in the first phase, with a doubling of the capacity, creating up to 20,000 jobs directly and indirectly. There's a number of implementation issues which are involved in this project, which includes the production of the feedstock itself, the issue of the regulations on the blend mix, which have been published for public comment, the issue of agriculture and industrial water licensing, the support or the subsidy measure for growers and refineries, and then the whole issue of fuel levy exemptions for biodiesel to be increased, as well as to be introduced in the case of bioethanol. And then the whole issue of the streamlining of licensing for small producers. This sort of gives some elaboration of fuel-based green energy and the waste-to-energy cogeneration. In order to achieve the target zone, there needs to be feedstock security. Feedstock security is absolutely essential for the success of this, and that means quantity, quality, and competitive pricing on the production of the feedstock. And that obviously provides opportunity of job creation through feedstock collection. And then there's various process and investment options, which are driven largely by feedstock qualities, quantities, the term and offtake options. And then you've got the high ratio of offtake or feedstock prices. So this is quite a technical slide, which I'm sure we could come back to in the discussions if we need to. There's also a number of processes and different types of fuel. And you've got different agricultural origins, which include livestock manure, agricultural residues, animal mortalities, and energy crops, with the industrial origin of wastewater, industrial sludge, industrial byproducts, and the municipal origin of sewage sludge, municipal solid waste, and food residues, and then the process technologies, which are anaerobic digestion, and then in terms of alien vegetation removal, forestry waste, and grown biomass, the industrial origin of timber mills residue and sugar mill residues, the municipal origin of green waste cuttings, and then the process technologies, combustion and gasification. And then also cogeneration from waste gas heat, solid waste. And there are different job creation expectations, which are high for feedstock collection and management. In terms of renewable energy, which is another main priority of government at the moment, it is an exciting time for renewable energy development, where we do in our country and region face an energy crisis. So there are opportunities nationally and regionally with significant investor interest flowing out of these, we need to secure 50,000 megawatt new generation capacity by 2030, with 19,000 of these to come from renewable technologies. And we have the launch of South Africa's renewable energy independent power producer procurement process, with the first round of bid submissions having closed now on Friday last week, and a very intensive process of reviewing these various bids, with the IDC targeting a 14 billion rand investment out of the total 20 billion IDC investment in the green economy over the next 5 years. That 22 billion, as we know, goes up to 25 billion if we look at the manufacturing of components for the green economy as well. So out of that, we're looking at 14 billion rand investment in renewables. This slide just shows the funding possibilities for projects, with project development through participation and cost sharing of bankable feasibility studies, looking at the maximum and minimum equity participation, the BEE and triple BEE funding, and debt participation, which I'm sure Rensha can expand on in the discussion, should we want to do that. So basically, the IDC has proactively sourced and developed projects for renewable energy, and there's a significant pipeline of projects that are currently bidding under the Renewable Energy Independent Power Purchase Procurement Program, which has been introduced by the DOE, Department of Energy, on a cap tariff basis. And the bid structure effectively was on a competitive bidding process where a tariff cap was set for each technology, with a total of 3,725 megawatts being available under the program with 5 bidding rounds. And the IDC's portfolio of projects for round one of this process was in excess of 800 megawatts, with a total of approximately 27 billion project value. This just gives a sense of the job creation potential and possibility in terms of the IDC projects in the area of concentrated solar power, wind, and photovoltaic, with the total pipeline job creation possibility of 5,500 jobs, with also opportunities for job creation through the manufacturing of components for renewable energy. In terms of the procurement program, the request for proposal highlights, as we've indicated, it's a 5-phase bid process. The first phase, submission of bids by last Friday, with the key qualification criteria being project structure, legal, land, financial, environmental, technical, economic development, and bid guarantee. Proven technology, the equipment must have been installed on 2 previous projects. The contractors must have a proven track record. A bid bond of 100,000 rand per megawatt must be provided, with the latter amount increasing to 200,000 per megawatt when the project is selected as a preferred bidder. And if the qualification is met, the bid will be evaluated mainly against price and economic development. with the price not to exceed the price caps for each technology. And there is an economic development matrix with a focus on jobs, local content, community, and skills development, which is illustrated in this slide to some extent. So this slide just shows some of the key highlights in terms of the request for proposals. In terms of the gatekeeping criteria, wind, photovoltaic, concentrated solar, and hydro. And it specifies the non-negotiable documentation, the fact that bidders must provide confirmation that equity is fully underwritten with preliminary approval for debt, and the bid must also be accompanied by auditor, sponsor, and banker case financial models. So again, this is just giving particular details which could be unpacked should the honourable members want to look at this particular aspect of things. We just put a few slides together on the COP17, which, as we all know, is taking place in Durban from the 28th of November to the 9th of December, where our Minister of International Relations and Cooperation will take over the presidency of the COP. And just a couple of key concepts. Adaptation, which refers to the processes and activities addressing our ability to adapt to the effect of climate change, such as climate variability and extreme weather events. And then mitigation, which are the activities geared towards mitigating the effect of greenhouse gas emissions and reducing global warming through alternative energy methods, reduced reliance on fossil fuels, and the rollout of new technologies. And just some of the areas which will be negotiated would include the Green Climate Fund to house the international management, deployment, and accountability of long-term funding for development for developing country support. The technology mechanism to get clean technologies to the right place at the right time and to the best effect. The adaptation framework to boost international cooperation to help developing countries to protect themselves from the impacts of climate change. And then a registry where developing countries will detail their voluntary plans to limit greenhouse gas emissions and the support they need to achieve them. Now, this is just a very sort of brief overview of some of the key issues and areas where negotiations will take place. There's something like more than 55 agenda items that will be covered in this two-week meeting. But these are just some of the key issues that will be on the table. This one just gives an indication of the climate change response exhibition, where EDD and IDC will be exhibiting the solar water heater rollout plan and a number of other departments as well, and various organizations, local and international, will be exhibiting. And this slide just gives the top 10 projects that will be exhibited. A whole lot of criteria were set up, and the IDC and EDD project of the mass rollout of solar water heaters will be part of the exhibition. And then there's a number of exhibits from the Department of Energy, the Gauteng, Department of Economic Development, Science and Technology, and so on and so forth. So Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I know it's quite a complex area, but hopefully this presentation has provided an overview of some of the key issues around the green economy, beginning with the policy framework in the New Growth Path and IPAP, also focusing on the integrated resource plan issues, around renewables, and then looking at where the key priorities are in terms of renewable energy, biofuels, and the solar water heater rollout, and then just engaging very briefly with some of the issues that are likely to be discussed at the COP17. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, DG. And thanks again to the committee whip. Can we request, DG, that in future, this is a very important and quite a huge presentation, in order for members to be able really to interact and also to participate effectively in the meeting in terms of interrogation of this of such reports. It's important that we get this report at least 3 days in advance. It is very important that members really refer to other documents and so they are able to participate in the meeting. Because as they get the briefing and the document, you can see all of us are busy trying to, you know, to combine what you are saying there and at the same time having to read and then put questions at the same time, which is not really working. If we can request that in future, we approach it in that fashion. I know that I did request previously. I did make that type of a request. But I will take it that I am following up on that request. Thank you very much. I know other committees will not even entertain reports that are not presented well in advance. But thank you very much, DG. This is quite informative and enlightening. And educating also, because some of us are hearing some of this information for the first time. And I think that the members were not wrong to request for such a briefing. Can we, members on our side, interact with the presentation? I recognize Dr. Rabi, Mr. Singh, Babuntuli, and then Mr. Mare. In that order, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Age before beauty, eh?
That's correct.
Age before beauty.
Madam Chair.
Whatever that means, Mr. Murray.
Yes. Professor Levine, thank you for the submission. I'd like to have some more detail. You mentioned there, I think it was on page 13, the rollout for SWH, the low pressure and the high pressure systems and so forth. Now, Chair, I'd like to know, has this been thoroughly investigated? Has this been researched? Is this a viable option? And will it has it been implemented in other sort of third world countries? I'd just like to get the views on that, because I think it's very important that we implement these particular the low pressure and the high pressure systems. The sooner we do it, the better. And I'd like to know whether there are certain target dates for the implementation of these particular systems. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree with you. It's difficult to absorb all this in a short while. So maybe I'll just ask from my own experience and from what's been presented on the three areas. The one is the solar water heaters. I mean, by and large, you know, I notice in KwaZulu-Natal and in Durban in particular, that most of the new houses, the low-income households that are subsidized by government, have these solar water heaters. Now, that's well and good. But what I'd like to know is, where are these heaters coming from? Are they coming from China? Are they coming from other parts of the world? And although I think in your presentation here you say that efforts are being made to support local production, but to what extent are local people going to benefit from the manufacture of these things? Because I do know of some people who are getting very rich. They're just importing these things. They have contracts with Department of Housing and everybody else, and they're installing this. So So that's something that I'd like to know. Secondly is, I mean, from a global point of view in South Africa, I mean, it's good to have solar water heaters in rural areas, and there's a project here that you've got. But the water comes first, and then the heater. Now, to what extent is a study being done, has been done to see where we don't have water yet? But people have just no access to water. They're still walking to rivers and collecting water and all sorts of things. Now, if we want to promote the solar water heaters, I mean, water is a prerequisite. Then the third thing on solar water heaters, you know, I went onto a website, a Tegwini, because you asked a direct question, how many of us have got solar water heaters? Well, I can put my hand up and say, no, I don't. But I went onto a website of a Tegwini Metro, and they said, well, if you're interested, you must give us your details. And this was 2 months ago. I said, my son-in-law, myself, and a few others, we put all our details for them to come back to us, and we can start, you know, maybe installing these things. Nothing. Fancy website, but no feedback whatsoever. Now, is it happening in other areas as well, a similar kind of thing? Because who do you approach? Approach Eskom? Do you approach a person who sells solar water heaters? What do you do? Then on biofuels, Madam Chair, I mean, you've got the Cradock program, yeah, I mean, what does it entail? I see you've got a number of jobs that can be created. I know in KwaZulu-Natal, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, we were looking at the planting of a crop. I just forget the biological name. Maybe you can remind me. Somebody will know it. But it was a crop that, you know, you could extract fuels and have a process of getting fuel. But what the challenge there was, you needed wide area, expansive area. And in the rural areas, we went there and we spoke to people. Now, planting that crop was against providing feed for the cattle. And people were resistant to saying, well, let's plant this thing here, which can be used for ethanol and fuel, because where are we going to get our feed from? So are these some kind of challenges that you're experiencing as you move forward, and what are we doing in that regard? Lastly, on renewable energy program, your last section, this bid that you're talking about, what are we expecting the successful bidder to do? I mean, and then how is it going to contribute to, you know, this renewable energy program? In simple terms, I know it's been explained here in technical terms, but in simple terms, I mean, here comes a bidder, wins a bid. Now what next for the country? Thanks.
Thanks, Professor.
Thanks, Chairperson, and I'll also like to welcome the presentation by the DG. Firstly, Chair, if we open up page 12, there's this guarantees for installed solar heaters in the event installers go out of business. Well, what does that mean? If you can be able to elaborate. Number two, as Mr. Singh has alluded at in KwaZulu-Natal, we have found that the prices of installing these heaters, it differs for different provinces. Like in KwaZulu-Natal, particularly eThekwini, you have to pay 500 rand for the installation. But when you go to Eastern Cape, it is free. And those two provinces are adjacent to each other. Sometimes people judge for, why are we paying here and you are not paying there? If you can clear that one. Number three, Chair, is the capacity building and mentoring. Do we have the money set aside? I remember that when we were talking with Walmart, and all, we said there is money needed for capacity building and mentoring for the small SMEs. Do we have any money set aside for that here? The fourth one is, it's like I'll build on what Honor was saying, but it's about water. I see that the stove heating and all these things, it will need a lot of water. Now I'm checking versus the building of the dams. Are we going to have the capacity to sustain? Lastly, Chair, is the feasibility study. I remember that the IDC, they said they are doing a feasibility study. And then there was a huge amount of money which was attached. I believe it was 84 million. Now I want to check how far is that? Is that was that feasibility study successful, or did you utilize all that amount of money, or what is it? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mare.
Thank you, Chair. Teacher, I think that the investment in green economy is probably, I think, one of the most exciting investments. And I think this is something where we can leave a fantastic legacy for our children for the future. I also believe that this is obviously the investment in this must be discounted over quite a long period, because this is a long-term investment. This is not, you know, 4 or 5 years or even 10 years or 20 years. I don't know what is the lifespan of, for instance, wind turbines and things like that. I'd like to know, you know, in other words, is this something that can last for 20 years in terms of the main investment? I know components and things like that wear and tear, you will always have. Just want that. Because, and then the other thing is, the main challenge, in my opinion, is going to be implementation and time frames. It sounds absolutely fantastic, and I think it sounds absolutely justifiable, but the test will be in terms of the effective implementation, and if you can give us more information on that and time frames in that regard. Then in terms of solar heaters, I must also admit I also don't have one. And the main reason is, and I think many people do that, they look at the cost of that, and then they discount the increased electricity cost, and they say, hey, it's going to take me 5 to 10 years before I repay this. I mean, it's not worth it. So somehow, consumers will do something if there's an incentive. If there's not an incentive, you know, they don't. They look at their pocket and not at the benefits of the green economy or the green environment. So somehow I feel that must become more relevant also in the implementation. You've mentioned about some of the challenges is the uneven provincial distribution. Can you give us more information on these different provinces? What are the reasons for this uneven distribution? Is it capability of implementing that, or is it poverty? Is it need? Is it what are these relevant elements that one must look at in that regard? Then, in terms of the renewable energy, it's obviously a huge lot of money that the IDC will make available for the sector. What will be the role of EDD? Is it just a facilitating role? Is there going to be a, call it a policeman role? Are you going to make sure that these strategies will be implemented, and if they don't comply, what then? Or will it just be between IDC and the Department of Energy and the different private sector role players in that regard? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, colleague Chair. Also expressing appreciation on the input made. But I'm immediately thinking of one area which we should not wait until it happens and then we then take measures. I know we once raised this before, where is it not easy to steal these
whole mechanism.
Can you change?
Is it, or maybe what? Is it not easy to steal this whole mechanism? Just like cars get stolen, and they are sold to scrapyard at 1% of the real cost. So we need to think of how to mount it such that it's not easy. And then the second part is to appreciate where a certain sum has been set aside for cooperatives, because if that is well done, it will assist in the narrowing of the gap and also spreading the benefits of this development. But then, on the training side, is it not appropriate that together with the higher education department, a serious training, intensive training that's done over a short period, that is undertaken, so that we don't necessarily look at it as a long-term. So that's one part. And then the capacity for maintenance, because that will also go alongside training. My last point is that it is still possible for us to be outwitted by other countries that will bring the product ready-made, that will argue that the product is cheaper if it comes from them. So we will really have to take measures to prevent that from happening. Thanks, Kovich.
Thanks, Bob Mabasa. Neto Jesse.
Thank you, Chair. On page 10, we talk about increasing local production of components. Who is our target in terms of producers? I'm asking this in conjunction with the youth employment, that whenever we talk about development and specific concerns, we talk about them as people who are seeking employment all the time. Are they targeted maybe within the group that is going to be assisted as producers?
Thanks, Ms. Odessen. DG, these are the questions, but I would love to add on the questions before we get to the second round of questions. I really appreciate the fact that in terms of the NGP, we are also targeting maintenance of the green economy infrastructure, if I were to put it that way. I just want to understand that whether are we going to do it under the NIM, which is the National Infrastructure Maintenance Act, and are we intending perhaps to amend that? Is public works, or is it going to be done, was that managed by public works? Or is it going to be the responsibility of the third line function department? For instance, that would be IDC, it would be Department of Energy, or whichever line function that is dealing with that. The reason I'm asking this was is, we don't want to, at the end of the day, to be creating this thing, especially with solar water heaters, which most of the time, if you provide them to low-cost housing, for instance, and then they have a challenge of not functioning, who's going to be responsible for that? Aren't we creating a lot of a burden to our rural poor again? And the capacity of our municipalities, are they going to be able, for instance, if we are given the management of maintenance to them. Are they, do they have the capacity to do that? I mean, if they were called and they could not respond, as one question says, I mean, in 2 months or so, is this going to be sustainable? Because if we talk sustenance of programs and projects, we have to question that. Because to me, the main aim is not just to do, you know, to implement projects. It's also to ensure that those projects become sustainable in the long run. I see this strategies as put in our NGP, supported by various line function departments, very, very, very good. But as I said, you know, strategies without actual implementation or inaction is going to be very difficult. And might, at the end of the day, bring out more challenges, as members were asking. While asking that, I just want to know, on the recycling scheme, who are we targeting? I know now, for instance, we have waste management, for instance, where we once visited Canada, not as this committee, in my previous employ. I'm still in my current life. Yes, we visited the Alberta province in Canada, where in they had a very huge waste management plant. They were recycling like tires, bottles, and they have a very good system of managing, you know, the waste. Wherein you have, for instance, the paint products that have chemicals and so forth, they have their own way of being, you know, managed and so forth and so forth. I haven't seen in our municipalities beginning to do that. And who are we targeting in terms of that type of work? Because when we create jobs, yes, we say that we are a youthful society in South Africa, but the fact of the matter, we still have the over 35 years who are still struggling, who are going to be first-time employers, who haven't even started getting employment. While we have the under 35s or up to 35s who are still energetic, who still have many, many more opportunities as youth and so forth, aren't we neglecting that, you know, that age cohort, for instance, of above 35? I know in some municipalities, especially around Ekurhuleni, they once started a project of river management, when they employed the over 40s. And they were giving at least 50 rands a day is too much for a person who's unemployed. And I thought that when it kept our rivers clean, it kept, you know, it promoted gardens and so forth, or recreational facilities. But at the same time, it created jobs for the over 40s. So I don't know, in terms of this recycling schemes, how are they, for instance, categorized, and how are they, what age groups, for instance, are they targeting? Because unless we go that route, we won't be able really to deal with the challenges facing us of unemployment in total, because I can see that many of our programs are targeting the youth. And at the end of the day, we will be leaving out certain people. We have people, for instance, who are plumbers, for instance, now, who are uncertified plumbers. And other artisans you can talk of in the country. They are not reached out by communication, because we know that our communication is not that effective in most ways. So how do we ensure through IDC or other line function departments that we really reach out to those people and they get certified, because we are saying there's a there's a high need, for instance, of plumbers in the country. Because I can see FET colleges might not, for instance, cope up with and be able to produce those numbers that we need. How about taking those that are uncertified but are practicing in our rural areas and train them and give them appropriate certificates so that they can then also be able to enter the entrepreneurship level. The Green Energy Efficiency Fund that was launched, can we get more information on this? I know we might sound a bit ignorant, but I think it's very important that as this committee we have the necessary information. The program again on solar heaters, DG. I think one member talked about the time frame, targets. I would include targets and also the effective implementation. I would like to add to that question by asking, because it's important that we unpack these things. We understand. We have a total understanding of what is going to take place. Right now, we don't have progress as to how far are you in terms of, you know, each thing. Or we might have left out something somewhere. I know that IDC tried to give us progress report in terms of numbers and so forth. But I would love us, you know, through you, DG, to consolidate not only that of IDC, but to give us consolidated progress report in as far as the implementation of some of these programs are concerned. Because I know that you are sitting in the cluster, or even in the project committees that are dealing with this thing. So it will be important that from time to time you give us progress reports so that we are able to check. For some of these targets, 2014, 2015, and so forth, we want to see whether are we in a position to reach those targets. And also to check whether, in terms of employment creation, we are able to go as far as our national growth path is envisaging us to. Yeah, I think other questions were asked, especially on the solar water heating. But it will be important also to get the total picture of the country, so how far have we gone? Because I know for a fact that there are so many houses that are envisaged to be built, especially on the low cost. I think it's Mr. Singh and Babuntuli asked the question around the accessibility or the affordabilities. I think it's both of the solar heating system. Where is this sourced from? Because previously there was this problem or challenge of immediately this was announced, I think it was 2008, you saw many people coming out, you know, providing this service. And if you go from shop to shop, or, you know, this big chain stores that are selling this, you know, you'll find that each municipality has a contract with another. And at the end of the day, there is no management of the whole project. While other municipalities are giving incentive, others are not yet. And there's no uniformity in the whole country as far as this is concerned. We need to get that as to how far is that, because there were, in some cases, we were promised that whoever reduces or whoever installs these energy saving devices will get a certain incentive, and municipalities had to sign for that. How far is that? So that as we talk, energy mix is something that is really taking place. It's not something that we're theorizing about. Can we get clarity as to how far are we, or have we gone as a country in terms of implementing this, so that we can see whether we are progressing or not? And I'm asking this bearing in mind that there is an implementing department, but as an overseer or coordinating department, and as a fund at IDC, and a tracker of progress, I think it's important that we give you this question so that you can also get them from others. The guarantees that you are giving out, how are they managed? Because the issues of training, the issues of mentorship and coaching, they are quite important. We've seen a situation where guarantees were given at the end of the day, government, you know, stays with the debt because, you know, businesses can't pay the whoever that they get money from. Are these guarantees to commercial banks, or are these guarantees to from IDC itself? I think this is very important that we get clarity on this. As much as we want to create businesses, but businesses have to understand that they have to be in business, so that also allow themselves to be given necessary capacity to be able to manage, so that we don't end up with a lot of losses. How many are targeted and set aside for cooperatives? Because if you have, because these were questions that were raised by the committee itself, and you are saying you have set aside, you have set aside certain installations for cooperatives. It's important that we get that number. How many? And also, where have you targeted such installers? In which part of the country? And also gender balance in terms of that. How many are females, how many are males in terms of what you've targeted? And how far have you implemented the certified program for installer? I think this is for those that have already been done. If there's a new one, can you give us your plan so that we can see whether it meets the committee's satisfaction or not? Let me end there for the first question, and then we can proceed with the rest in the second round of questions. DG, may I hand over to you? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll do some responses, then I'll hand over to Rensha, who will fill out a lot of the details. And firstly, we do note the instruction to submit in advance. We'll make sure that we do that in future. A lot of the questions did focus on the solar water heater rollout. And I think it's important to indicate that currently EDD is trying to play a coordination role that we have discussed on several occasions in this committee. We don't directly control any of the levers, but I think we are succeeding in bringing the key role players together: Department of Energy, Department of Public Enterprises, ESCOM, IDC, National Treasury. I think those are the key, but there's a number of other players as well, in terms of SALGA, in terms of science and technology, in terms of rural development and land reform. So we are actually trying to formulate a solution where currently there isn't one. So some of the specifics you're asking for, it's difficult to commit at this particular stage, but it's because it's things we are grappling with right now. And I think the emphasis that a number of committee members have placed on implementation is going to be critical. But having sort of made that qualification, I think it's important to say that right now, in the current financial year, we're looking at in the region of 200,000 systems to be installed. And if we're going to make the target of 2015, that's another 800,000 systems, which is 22,000 systems per month. And we could roughly divide those into 17,000 low pressure and 5,000 high pressure systems per month, if we're working on a linear model. But one of the big challenges with this whole rollout is around the funding mechanisms and arrangements, which, as the presentation indicated, would differ in terms of the low pressure systems and the high pressure systems. The low pressure systems is where we can get a contracting model in place. That's where we can begin to set the specific targets around set asides, for example, around the employment issues, including youth employment. And I'll make some comments on that issue as well in a moment. And the localization. The issue is, where do they come from? It may be possible to hit the target and have imported systems with no localization. So the contracting model offers us the possibility of specifying local content. Now, there are low-pressure systems which come fully from China, for example. And this picture just sort of indicates the different components that make up a solar water heater. And I think if we look at the storage tank, the outer case, the stand, the reflector, and even the heat pipe, there's definitely local competitive capacity that could produce these. It's really the tubes that is going to be very difficult to compete with for China. So the whole issue of the standard for local content will be one of the issues that needs to be cracked in terms of the contracting model. But I think that is an important question, because if we just go for the target without thinking of all the other objectives which you want to achieve, new growth path objectives, then we hit the target, but we don't get youth employment, we don't get localization, we don't even get even or equitable distribution across the provinces, we just get the target. So I think it raises the complexity of the whole rollout, but I think we do need to focus on our primary objectives of job creation through, amongst other things, local content and local production. Obviously, the questions on water, which were raised by a few of the members, are very pertinent. And this is predicated upon availability of water. Otherwise, we run out into places where you've got no running water on tap, and then you've just got a house with a solar water heater on, which is completely dysfunctional. And I think the water question is another question, and it's a key question as well. I think we can sort of try and follow up on what happened with the inquiries on, you know, Ekegwini website. Obviously, that is an issue of major concern.
But this is a uniformity part of that question, I think, the country-wise uniformity.
Yes. I'll comment on that. I'm sure Rensha will fill out some of the details. But the key funding mechanism is the rebate. Okay. And certain municipalities, in conjunction with local suppliers, have responded to that. So if you actually look at the graph, you find Eastern Cape is highest, and that's because the initiative is taken within the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro to respond to that opportunity
which happens through the rebate. Now, obviously, if we have this contracting model, if we can pull it together and implement it, then we can do bulk sort of allocations, as it were, which will allow us to achieve across the provinces that equitable distribution that we seek. Okay, I think just to sort of comment on this, the youth employment question, because it is a bigger question as well, and the chairperson did pose it in a particular way, and I will kind of risk an opinion on this, because I think the question is very important the way it was posed, and I think it goes to the heart of the debate as well around the youth wage subsidy, and that is the fear of substitutionism, as it were. Because if the youth wage subsidy is rolled out without any qualifiers, then there is a real risk of displacement of older workers and a breakdown of social cohesion. I think, you know, it's in particular areas where you have skills and, you know, the whole problem we talk about unemployed graduates, I think that's where, if we can identify those sort of niches, as it were, for a youth wage subsidy, then we won't have the problem of substitutionism. Because I think that's what the Honourable Chairperson was referring to in a broad sense. Of course, she raised it in the context of the whole issue of recycling schemes and who they're targeting. And clearly that is an untapped potential. So there are some provinces which are currently putting together projects and proposals around recycling. But I think some of those are still in their formative stages. I know the Free State is putting together some projects. And I think we'd have to check with them, for example, whether there are specific targets. But I think there is a huge opportunity in the area of the social economy and the second economy more broadly for us to stimulate livelihoods, job opportunities through recycling schemes. And perhaps Rensha would also have something to add on that. But having made those observations, I'd now ask Rensha to go through the issues that have been raised in greater detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honourable members. Maybe just as a quick update on solar water heaters, Eskom do produce on a weekly basis a dashboard, and I'll just open this here just to give you a sense. To date, on high pressure, close to 34,500 heaters have been installed and close to 100,000 on low pressure systems. About 464 million through rebates has been spent on low pressure systems and 203 million on high pressure. With a remaining balance of the budget for this financial year of about 357 million rand. Maybe just to put it in perspective, and that will give you a bit of an idea of what's currently happening and why we see a bit of a slowdown. Eskom has announced about three months ago that they will have stringent criteria, so they are limiting, for example, companies that install high-pressure systems not to submit more than 200 claims per month. On low pressure, 1,000 claims per month. So what they're trying to do is to manage the budget that they've got remaining for the rest of the financial year and trying to assist as many companies as possible. Together with that, they also introduced the whole philosophy of local content, which we as IDC welcomed. We put a lot of pressure on Eskom to actually support that, and in the last announcement 3 months ago, it was very clear that you will get a higher rebate. if you use a locally produced system. Of course, as the DG indicated, on the low pressure systems you can't buy any of the evacuated tubes locally, and that is one of the components that we see we will continue to import from China. But be that as it may, I think we do see a number of companies being closed down. I think yesterday in the papers there was another company in Stellenbosch producing solar water heaters that are actually stopped manufacturing. For us as IDC, it's a real concern. We currently have a few companies on our books that's doing installation of these systems. And part of our criteria when we give them money in the form of a loan is that they must use locally procured systems, or at least 70% of those systems must be locally procured. Just a reference to the target companies of our countries and what is the norm, I can assure the committee today that the government has done a significant amount of work to see what type of rebate system can work. We got examples from Tunisia and other developing countries where it's very clear that the rebate system initially is the best way to actually unlock increased development in the sector. With, of course, when you move into to the third or the fourth year, you look at the standard offer type of proposal, which the government is currently considering as well. Just very briefly, how that works is you've got an annuity type of instrument where you will then not get the rebate on day one, but you will get the savings as you use the system. Now, to kickstart an industry, the consumer wants his 5,000 or 6,000 rand rebate on day one. He doesn't want to earn that over a period of 5 or 6 years as he saves his electricity, which, of course, creates a challenge at this point in time. Just very briefly, my response to the Itakweni question, I mean, that is unacceptable. We sit with a number of companies with nice websites. They are misleading the customer, and that's partly why we sit currently with an industry that's not taking off to the extent that we would like to see that happening. And what we need to do is remove them from the system and really work with companies that are serious, that are working with Eskom and funders like the IDC to increase the rollout. And I think it's very important that you report that to Eskom, because they're very strict. They're also doing a number of spot checks at the moment, pilots, where they go back to companies, see if they've done the maintenance, if that's up to scratch, and if the households actually get the service that they are supposed to get. Just maybe another comment on solar water heaters, and then I'll go to biofuels and renewable energy.
On that information, it's very important because it really frustrates consumers. What is then the role of IDC as a funder in terms of that? You know, because it's important. Eskom would have that information or the website with the list, but at the end of the day, you as a funder can determine who, for instance, should remain in that list.
Yes. I think Jay, absolutely correct. We as IDC see our role as being one of a responsible citizen as well, assisting Eskom to roll this out, and I can assure you, you may not be pleased to hear this, but we only got three companies on our books at the moment, and it's because we have very stringent criteria when we fund them. There's a lot of fly-by-night. What we've done, we're working very closely with Eskom, and what we do see is that if we pick up anything in the industry that's not to our satisfaction, we report them to Eskom, and we will not assist in funding them going forward. I don't think the IDC's role is to watch the industry as a watchdog, but surely we can influence it through our funding and making funding available in developing the industry.
So can I come again, CG, on this matter? Because really we have to sort it out. And if members have follow-ups on those, also must do so. We, as a country, we are committing to a particular, you know, project. And so far, I haven't seen that coordination, and which is the problem or challenge of the department. We need to ensure that coordination, and
not just coordination, also synergy around, you know, the implementation is very important. That would include communicating correct information and also ensuring that whoever is in the database, because it's not about companies, it's about government. At the end of the day, they're saying government is not responding successfully. You are promising people this, but then in terms of the response, you are not responding. And it's important that also as a cluster or department or a team dealing with this, you correct that impression. Because what's in the minds of people is that we like promising and we don't stick to our promises. Can we perhaps request the DG just to tell us what is the role of the EDD in ensuring that there is that coordination, and what is set by IDC, what is set by ESCOM, what is set by municipalities and provinces and whatever is one. We are one country, we can't be sending different messages or committing to something else that is supposed to be implemented by somebody who really doesn't have a clue as to how then they should be implementing that.
Thanks, Chairperson. As I indicated, the role we're currently playing in the solar water heater rollout is a coordinating role. And I indicated the key players that we have from actually coordinating this process. And in coordinating this process, we are trying to come with a common message. And I think we are making progress. You've got Department of Energy, you've got ESCOM, you've got Department of Public Enterprises, in as much as ESCOM falls within the ambit of DPE, and we've got the National Treasury, and we've got the IDC. So that's who I did identify as the key players, but there's a whole lot of other players as well. For example, Science and Technology, Public Works, Rural Development and Land Reform. So we are indeed trying to play that coordination role and bring about a coordinated, focused effort into the process, which is very much focused at the moment on coming up with a funding mechanism, but also addressing all the kinds of issues that have been raised by the committee, including sustainability, and then all the new growth type objectives of local content, employment, set aside for cooperatives, and so on. So we are actually playing that role, and I believe we're making progress. The proof, of course, will be in the pudding, which is the actual implementation.
Okay. How often should we check on your DG in terms of progress? Should we say we're going in the next quarter to get the progress report and progress from where we are?
I think that's perfectly in order. And we certainly, at the end of this week, we're going to look at a major scenario which is being put together by some of the technical people for discussion with the technical team, where we're going to look at the funding side of it in particular, because that's critical as well, is the actual funding mechanism. Anyway.
Okay. Should is treasury inclusive of DBSA?
Actually, I would say DBSA is also a key role player in this as well, and they are part of the steering committee.
Okay. Interesting.
Chair, my comrade is just reminding me the funding question. You know, the cooperatives, things like that. How much is set aside for cooperatives and things like that? I don't think maybe you venture coming to it. Mm. But I firmly believe that there's more impetus needed on this coordination. There might be coordination. For example, in an area where I come from or I operate, there's low-cost housing, lovely houses, but half of them have got solar heaters. And the other co-goers come to you and say, hey, Mpana Singh, why haven't we got these things? Why shouldn't we be saving money? So where is it the Department of Housing? Is it local municipalities? is who decides where solar heaters should be put. So I think that's the coordination board. But the companies that you referred to through your chair, maybe we need to know who those companies are. Because we can also be kind of role models in our own localities. I mean, if we say, right, Mom Satsetsi will go and have this installed, and the neighbors will come and say, hey, but who did this and how did it happen? And then we can pass leads on and that kind of thing. So I think we need to be given that kind of information as well.
Thank you. Samara, and then
Babu. Chairperson, I'm not quite sure, but I don't think my particular questions has
is
been
follow up.
No,
follow up.
No, it's a question that hasn't been answered.
No, they are coming. We were just making follow up. Sorry,
we were just making follow up on the solar heaters.
Yeah, I think the inconsistencies are actually opening up for the fair net you're talking about. If we have
discrepancies.
Thanks
for the comment. You may proceed.
Maybe just to clarify one of the two questions with regard to guarantees and the funding model of IDC. When we review companies that we consider for funding, one of the very important factors is that they are sustainable and they are able to provide a service, a guarantee, and be able to come back and do proper maintenance. So the funding structure that we've done in one of the examples that was shared by the DG in his presentation is where you use the carbon credit mechanism, the CDM mechanism, and that project has worked extremely well in giving a free offer to the low pressure systems, to the households, by using the carbon credits to actually fund the maintenance portion of these systems. So it's a bit complicated, but in essence what you do is you register a program and you get income through a CER revenue over a period of time as you save electricity and emissions. And that over that period of time is sufficient enough to service and give the companies enough money to pay for maintenance. Now, we've only done that in one company where we got a national rollout at the moment, and that's also why we're so supportive of the contracting route that the government, coordinated by EDD, is currently proposing, because that will give you the opportunity to be able to influence how you contract and how you do the maintenance as well. IDC do not offer guarantees. I think maybe just to clarify that. We will not offer a guarantee to a company or on behalf of a company to the household in terms of maintenance. We will not do that. We will fund a company to assist in to match the rebate as well as working capital based on a CDM mechanism to be able to be sustainable to provide the necessary guarantees and maintenance and services. So that's why it's very important not to support the small one-man show or company that actually won't be able to have a sustainable rollout model. Just on the cooperatives, I think this is one of the objectives or initiatives that we're currently investigating through the steering committee. We have not yet funded any cooperative models yet in solar water heaters, but we do believe that there's an opportunity, once you've established the contracting route, to be able to do that quite successfully. A comment with regard to the different wards in a municipality and how...
Does that mean the set-aside is reported here? Is something that is being envisaged and therefore that doesn't really exist? Because we took it that these are some of the issues that you are dealing with. In terms of the implementation of the green economy.
It's under committee discuss the following issues and challenges. That
yes, and your responses.
Yes, it's something that is currently being discussed and developed. It's not yet implemented.
It's not yet implemented,
yes.
But these are the issues that you're going to...
Yes.
Okay, wanted to understand that.
Okay.
But then I think what we said, you must incorporate into your discussions so that you can come with solutions to that.
Thank you, Chief. Just to comment on the allocation, what we find is that you have various municipalities, some of them very proactive, others less proactive. In the case of the company we funded, they are currently involved in 6 different municipalities. They're very successful at the moment in the Eastern Cape with Nelson Mandela, where there's a significant rollout, also in the Free State. One of the challenges is that you need to have a very good relationship between the municipality and the company that's doing the installation. We find that in many cases there's a lot of energy from both sides, but with the recent reduction in number of installations from Eskom's side, it did slow down the rollout of installations of low-pressure systems in various municipalities, to the extent that the company that we funded are now at the capacity to roll out 10,000 heaters, low-pressure systems a month, but are limited by Eskom only to do 1,000 because of budget constraints. Therefore, it's critical that the approach that EDD is currently following to bring everybody around the table, coordinate and ensure that there's enough money available to have a sustainable program, that we can actually fulfill that. Also important to note is that Eskom's key priority is to reduce demand on the grid. Now, how do you do that? It's by focusing on the high pressure system. So their objective is really to use the allocated budget and try and prioritize the high pressure rollout of those systems. So that's why it's critical that when you focus on the low pressure system that you understand the different challenges, and therefore the rebate system and contracting route is the best way to go. Maybe if I could just comment on biofuels, the project in Clarock.
No, the names of the companies, do you have them for us? That's what, there was a request for that?
Yes, Jay. The one company that we funded is called, it's referred to in the slides, is SASA. It's the Tassel geyser that they will roll out. It's South African Sub-Saharan Academy, under the brand of Tassel. They've rolled out 64,000 of the low-pressure systems to date through a lot of engagement between IDC and the company. They started their own local manufacturing plant as well, and they're in the process of producing their own tanks and also going to do the frames by the end of this year. The other funding model that I can also maybe just mention is where we fund an intermediary. Now, this is more on the high-pressure system side, where we will fund a company at, for example, under our Green Energy Efficiency Fund at attractive interest rate, and then they on-lend to the household, because we as IDC do not fund individual households. And there we funded one or two intermediaries who is currently putting funding out to the households to assist them to be able to buy systems. In those cases, we do not have a direct involvement in who they choose or who they partner with. However, we do have a sense of companies that they do use. I can forward some names to the committee. With regard to biofuels, I think...
Just a second, Dr. Rav, you had a follow-up, quickly.
Anche, yes. Countries such as Israel and Spain use a lot of solar energy for agro-processing and so forth. Has the IDC given any thought to implement this ecosystem to subsistence agro-farmers as well in this country, especially in the western part of the country? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, under our fuel-based energy strategies, we're looking specifically at biogas, waste to energy, and there we're running, or we're considering 3 pilots at the moment with companies or farmers where you can use the biogas, whether it's a pig farm or poultry or various different of waste sources to generate electricity. The other opportunity, of course, is solar. What we find at the moment is that there's so much emphasis on solar with regard to the whole renewable procurement process that the off-grid solutions are being neglected to a certain extent. However, we believe that that's a solution for rural South Africa, to look at off-grid solutions, and I can certainly share a few ideas with the committee with regard to that. maybe while we're on renewable energy, one of the questions was what's expected from the bidders. Now, Madam Chair and committee members, I think I must really applaud the process that DOE and National Treasury followed on the renewable energy IPP procurement program, and the table that you will see on, I think it's page 25, will give you an idea of how stringent government is in terms of these projects. You have to supply to the grid by commercial operation date, the earliest being June 2014. So if you get preferred bidder status on the 28th of November, you get a PPA from government for 20 years. You have to accept that PPA. You can't negotiate that. And then by signing those agreements, being the PPA, the implementation agreement, as well as the direct and connection agreement, you accept the conditions imposed on you, that you will be able to have financial close on your project by end of June this year, and also that you will be able to supply into the grid by those dates as per the different technologies. The date on CSP is a bit later, it's a year later. The reason for that is these are significant, it's big projects. I think the smallest one IDC currently is developing is a 50 megawatt tower project of about 4.5 billion. The others are in the range of 75 megawatt and 100 megawatt. But I think it's very clear that government wants to see these projects supplying into the grid as soon as mid-2014. The lifespan of the projects, I think that was also a question. If you get a 20-year PPA, obviously you hope that your equipment and your solar farm and your wind farm will be able to last for 20 years. However, it's proven that these type of investments and projects do have a lifespan of up to 30 years. So currently, as per the government process, you will get a 20-year PPA, and of course, after the 20 years, you can apply for a renewal at the end of that period. I don't know if there was any other specific questions with regard to renewable energy. I do agree it's a long-term focus, it's a long-term approach, and a lot of emphasis on creating a sustainable industry. Just a comment on the biofuel side, the Cradock project. It's not an easy project. We as the IDC started off looking at sugar beet. It's now a grain sorghum.
Sugar beet.
It's now a grain sorghum project with a second phase being sugar beet, with most of the jobs being created on the feedstock side, the growing of the feedstock. And of course, with a number of job opportunities as a second phase or indirect job creation.
Then social security effect?
I think one of the
what we
see is in terms of government policy that it's very clear that you can't use any feedstock that will have an impact on food security. Grain sorghum has been identified as one of the feedstock that could be used for bioethanol, so we feel comfortable that could be the solution when you look at bioethanol. Of course, there's opportunities with bagasse as well, and many of the sugar players are talking to IDC. At the moment, they claim that they can put 1 gigawatt of electricity into the grid within a year. I think the main challenge with regard to the sugar industry is that there's not yet a framework in place to allow them to sell into the grid. The current price that they can get is the same price as a cogen, which is 67 cents, which is not sustainable if you look at where the electricity prices are going. Sorry, Chair, there was one question on solar water heaters, if you allow me just to get back. The question about in different regions, why is the one getting it free and the other one is paying? I think it's also something that I would like to comment on. If you look at the company that I've mentioned and their business model is based on a free offering. However, in some of the municipalities, they may partner with different companies where there is a different funding model in place. I can assure you that the one that we funded, it's a free model where they get permission from the municipalities to roll it out in certain wards, and it's based on that financial model. So I'm not aware of other cases, but it could be that the municipality partnered with a financial intermediary that's rolling out in a certain area where there's a small payment that's required.
In terms of distribution, can you also brief the committee if, I mean, you have very few companies that you're dealing with, and the intention is not to continue with very few. Have you identified those with potential, and are you able to train them, mentor them, make sure that they are also at the level you require, for instance, to be funded? You haven't, because I'm also because I know at the back of my mind that the companies you're talking about are companies that are well established, and they will continue to be established, and those that are upcoming will not have that opportunity to get the experience to get whatever to be at that level. So are you at IDC, because that's your also part of your mandate, to ensure that you also develop the emerging companies that have a potential of reaching macro level, to also be able to be where you are in terms of your requirements?
Just to build on this, Chair, I hope you remember the problem we had with the intermediaries, particularly Kula and Samas, where you find that they implement differently, and they are charging, that there is inconsistency among themselves. We find that site, they are charging the site. Now I'm worried about this outsourcing, that once you start relying on these intermediaries, it's a huge problem, where you find that they are not operating the same. Some of them are charging high interest, some of them doing different things. So I was just wanted to say, let's be careful. I'm afraid of the same scenario with the Samas and Kula, where we let everything to the intermediaries and they start abusing.
Chair, can I just follow up on your question as well about the few companies? You see, because we don't want to have a situation where you start creating monopolies, because that's dangerous. Because I
didn't want to use that.
Yeah.
I avoided that.
Because I understand SABS certification is also a very complex thing. It's a challenge to many emerging companies that want to have some of their systems certified. So, I don't know, one needs to strike a balance here between how do you encourage, as you say, emerging companies to get into the market vis-a-vis the bigger companies now that, because if there's only three companies and only one has been mentioned, SASA,
Yeah.
If I might say, in response to your question and the last comment, I agree. Part of the whole intention of the contracting route is exactly that. Because most of these companies, if you don't have scale, you won't survive. So what we're trying to do through the coordination of EDD is to say, allocate contracts, and IDC being part of evaluating the company after bid award in terms of seeing whether they can be able, whether we can fund them. So Eskom will review. We got already a term sheet on the table, which we said we can propose to them. But I think this route is the best to create more companies that are competitive and sustainable. And I think absolutely it's part of our role to create a number of successful companies and not only focusing on one that already has been developed. Just to come back to the intermediaries and the concept around that, I think it's totally different from your experience with Kula and Summit. In this case, it's only for high-pressure systems. So it's a company that's a financial intermediary. What they do is IDC will on them to them. We got certain checks and verification in place through our post-investment monitoring department, and they have to report to us in terms of the number of installations as well as the M&V measurement and verification and saving of CO2. They got accredited companies that they will use to do the installations. an IDC will monitor that. So it's only for high pressure systems, it's not for low pressure.
Ma'am, we have also an experience with IDC, I must say, especially when we're dealing with issues related to the economic crisis. That, what do you call that program? The framework agreement, yeah, the bailout scheme. I think we're in IDC led monitoring. Because in this case, you may find that you are perpetuating things that really, in terms of your mandate and objective, you're not supposed to. But they're being perpetuated at an operational level. And how to ensure that, for instance, the DG, that is not happening in this case. Because that's where competition is eliminated and you have only one or two players in place. You continue to write, you know, to give certain points for a particular company against others with an intention of, for instance, sustaining a particular company. I'm worried with the approach that is there, because in as far as I'm concerned, it's perpetuating. The intervention you're coming up with, how long will it take, for instance, to get to, because they're not waiting. The process is continuing, and other people are being left behind. How to ensure that we bridge that gap? We have as many role players as possible so that you don't have people who are, you know, who don't have any competition. And as a result, we know the issues around pricing, the issues around quality and so forth. You can't complain because there's only one service provider and so forth. I know I'm putting you on the block, but unfortunately, these are the real questions that we have to ask that would assist in ensuring transformation while at the same time there's development happening.
Well, I think you've raised the issues and
engaged the IDC on them. I'm not sure if I would like to preempt that kind of engagement.
That's fine. As long as they're taken care of, I'm happy.
Chair, I think there was one question with regard to the Green Energy Efficiency Fund and more detail around that. Maybe just very briefly to share with the committee, we believe that this is quite unique, where many of the companies would like to do energy efficiency, but if you look at the pricing, it's normally expensive for them to do it. So if you price energy efficiency loan at prime plus 2 or prime plus 3, many of these companies are not interested to do that. The reason being is there's not a lot of collateral available, and IDC price also on development impact. And this is not really a high job-creating sector of the green economy. To roll out electrofitting of lights or even change a boiler to be more electricity-friendly, it's not necessarily creating a lot of jobs. So what we've done is we've partnered with KfW, and they've given us a subsidized loan on the back of IDC balance sheet with grant money from the German government to assist us on technical assistance. And we're passing that benefit from an interest rate perspective directly through to the client. The uniqueness of this product, it's a prime lease too, a minimum loan of R1 million, a maximum loan of R50 million. The fund size is currently R500 million. It was launched about a week or so ago with a press release, and we already got three examples of companies that we funded with testimonials. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a lot of appetite, a lot of inquiries. We also got a live website where prospective clients can register an inquiry, and we will get back to them within a period of 2 days in terms of what we need. The uniqueness of the fund is also the long tenor, and you saw that to get a 15-year loan for a small amount is quite unique, where we will look at the payback period of the intervention. And if, for example, it's electrofitting of your lights, that's a short period, it's a 3-year payback, we can match that. So the idea is that you pay the loan through your savings. So there's not a net cash outflow for the company, but they actually pay from savings. And that we find is quite attractive to companies because it does not burden their cash flow at the moment, where they're already under strain from a cash flow perspective. And indirectly saving jobs, because they don't have to retrench people to be able to be sustainable. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Rasha, for the responses and the teaching. Can we, I don't know, the minister still coming?
Okay, it's just two questions of mine that I'm not sure.
That are not responded to? Okay, can
one would be the inequality or the unevenness of provincial distributions. I don't know if the DG responded to that.
I thought they both responded to that.
And then also in terms of incentives, in terms of the high pressure system, I think, whether it is, you know, the cost of that, and I know you've touched on that, but I mean, it doesn't answer the question in terms of whether there's incentives or how do you expect people to take up. And that's probably not an IDC issue, but more an EDD issue.
Is it not a policy matter?
Well, I think we'll both respond, but I think really the issue is a national awareness campaign where government, business, community, labor, I think the whole society needs to come together around raising awareness. And certainly we are currently finalizing a green economy accord where that is one of the issues which will flow out of the accord. But ultimately it is going to be about awareness raising and national interest concerns. Not easy to have a ready-made answer, because I think it's all of us in the room that need to contribute to raising that awareness. But I think that's where I would see the answer to the real answer to that particular question. But there are...
But it's on the rebate by ESCOM. Is that the one? The awareness, what is it on?
The awareness of the importance of, you know, protecting the environment and climate change, and the steps that each one of us can take as individuals, as households, to mitigate the effect of climate change through buying into, as it were, this new alternative technology. I think that's really my interpretation of where the nub of the answer is to the question.
Okay, are you satisfied, Mr. Murray? Thank you.
I think maybe Rensha wanted to just reiterate.
On the pain.
Well, maybe she can comment on that, but also just to reiterate the equitable distribution issue.
Okay.
Maybe just to add to that, what we found over the last 3 months since July, a huge spike in the allocation of rebates for high pressure systems, and it was really driven by the increase in electricity prices. So I think that's also a driver that we should not underestimate. And I fully agree with the DG awareness, and that's what we're trying to assist with, because there's a lot of confusion in the market. There's so many products that I can choose from. What should I choose? Then I rather don't make a decision. So that's partly what we're trying to manage. But we clearly saw a high spike in the rebates in high pressure systems since July. So it's an important driver that we should not underestimate. In terms of the equitable distribution, I think I commented earlier, but what we would really like to see is more proactive municipalities driving the change, driving the implementation. I think IDC and local government partnering through the various departments, there's a lot of opportunity there, and that's certainly where I see a lot of growth.
Okay. Mr. Mare, I thought you said you responded to.
No, just on this last issue, the role of provinces, because you've only referred to, you know, the municipalities, and some responded and some not. But to what extent is provinces, provincial governments, the, you know, the provincial NECs responsible for local government being you know, involved in that? Because that is really the step down.
Okay. That's why I said that team led by the EDD should ensure that they set up actually the policy around the things, because you can't have somebody responding, whoever wants to respond. It's a country's project. And in as far as I remember, we're a unitary state, and we should really respond, especially with regards to projects in that fashion too. There shouldn't be that it's a willing response. I'm not talking willing buyer, willing seller, just willing response. Mr. Singh and then Babuntuli.
Yeah.
Methodist, you're welcome.
Chair, thank you very much. Just to follow up on the responsibility of the citizens and households, I think, yes, we do have a responsibility, but the citizens need also to be supported by government and through programs, like municipalities need to be supported. When you go abroad, you'll find bottles here, plastic there, paper somewhere else. Every household has got those three bins. If you go to a site, a waste disposal site, you'll put your bottles here. That hardly happens here in South Africa. That's where it starts. I mean, our national flower in most parts of the country is plastic bags. Wherever you go, you just see them strewn all over. But if this has value, because it has value, plastic has value. I mean, there are success stories of people that collect cardboard and other things that are, you know, very, very rich people today, ordinary people from the street that have started this. Now, what kind of, how does one encourage people now to see that out of this waste there is you can derive an income, and what can IDC do in that regard to support municipalities on particular kind of projects? Because a lot of people without any skills can just get into those kinds of activities and derive an income. And then also, you know, if we start separating, now if are there bins that can be provided? Can we have pilot municipalities or something like that? Pilot municipality where these things can happen and then it can catch on to the rest of the country.
Thank you. Let's welcome the minister. We'll come to brief you shortly.
Thanks, Chairperson. Building on what Mr. Singh has said, this carbon credit thing where we say it happens in my constituency, I said there is carbon credit thing coming when you plant a tree to reduce carbon dioxide, then you'll be able to get something in return. Oh, people were excited, and where do we go? Now, I can't say where are they supposed to go. I've said it. Now, it's a good thing. I said, for those people who are not working, if you do this, you'll be, hey, what is that now? Where? I don't know. Number two, I'm glad that the minister, maybe he will be able to. There is a protest about coal at Eskom, where people have occupied because they don't want the coal now, they want it to stop now. What will be your response? Let's say they come to you as a green economy thing. Now these are people are saying, stop this thing, don't want the coal. We want this green economy. Then what is your response?
Majesty, clarity seeking, you know, the situation here. I'm no longer sure whether the follow-up are still on energy or with other questions as well.
Now it's broad. It's broad. We're still on any green economy issue.
Yeah, my question earlier on was on youth employment versus the production of local components. That you get excited whenever we hear something about employment for youth.
But at the same time, it is worrying that what happens to them after the completion of that project. Don't we have something, like I was asking, is there any target in as far as the production of local components concerned that is planned for you specifically, especially those who already have training from FET colleges? And again, those who are not trained but through acquiring skills as they are working in the project, what happens to them after the completion of the project?
Thank you. Just before the DG respond, can we welcome the minister? We're glad that you're here, as promised, especially after the concern that was raised by members here that you're not that frequent. You're not frequent in the meeting. I'm glad that today they can see you and they'll be able to talk to you. We are in a process of asking questions. Actually, this is the second round of questions. We have included in the questions policy issues that I think the DG has managed to respond to them. But I think as members ask questions, they must remember now that the minister is here. If we have any policy-related questions on the green economy, let's do so. But maybe before I allow the DG to respond, let's allow the minister then to give us in general, because I know that he has, he's aware of the presentation, just to say a few words that or the message that he wants to give us. Can I hand over to you, minister? Maybe the responses to the questions asked now will come from the few remarks that you'll be giving us.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning still to members of the committee. I'm sorry that I was not able to be here from the start. But as the Chair may have explained to you, today we had what may well be our last interministerial committee meeting that deals with COP17 before this conference actually takes place. And this, of course, is one that we're hosting in South Africa. And not only do we want to be good hosts and run a successful conference, but we also want to make sure that the outcomes speak to the powerful needs of developing countries who also share the responsibility to address climate change. Chairperson, members of the committee, I think what the presentation has done, it's lifted out a few key areas, what we regard as immediate priorities on the green economy. But the challenge is so large that we've got to think of our program being beyond these three key areas. They embrace a number of other initiatives, which, because we wanted to keep the presentation focused, we didn't go into the detail on. They include, for example, projects elsewhere in the continent. If we can unlock the green energy from Inga, we can fundamentally transform the industrial trajectory of Southern Africa, because there you have an enormous quantity of green energy which can be produced at a cost significantly below most other technologies. They include existing programs. Members of the committee may be pleased to know that South Africa currently has about 15% of the global production of autocatalytic converters, that which goes into exhaust pipes to reduce the carbon emission. And so we can build on those successful platforms in our auto component program to ensure that it's not just in the generation of energy, but also in a range of other manufacturing support areas that we can make progress. So I've highlighted two illustrations, but perhaps in the course of discussions we can mention many others that are currently within our frame. Let me say also that climate change is not only an issue for advanced manufacturing processes, for urban dwellers, for those who are concerned about the shape of the advanced manufacturing economy. The United Nations Development Programme and the WTO released a study not too long ago that shows that something like 500,000 Africans die every year from preventable diseases caused by the use of solid state fuels inside their homes. And so you'd have death from child pneumonia, from chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases, and from lung cancer. Now consider 500,000 people. That's the equivalent of every man, woman, and child in a city the size of Copenhagen dying every year. But because this happens in rural villages, in areas outside of the media mainstreams, they don't become the compelling thing that galvanize us. So for us, the Solo Tegiza project, the programs to promote clean cooking stoves are absolutely fundamental on the continent. Not only can it save human lives in significant numbers, I mean, these are absolutely devastating numbers that the WHO has come out with. But they also provide a source for industrialization, for human beings to manufacture goods that can help to mitigate and address the challenges of climate change. We've set ourselves, Chairperson, a very ambitious target on green energy. And if one thinks about 17,000 megawatts of green energy, that's about three times the entire energy output, the entire electricity output of Nigeria at present. And that's the target we've set ourselves as South Africa. And we recognize it comes with costs. Based on existing technologies, green energy is more expensive. Solar and wind energy is more expensive than coal-based energy. We hope that with changes in technology, the enormous investment that countries and companies are making across the world, that the price of green energy can come down over time. So for us, if I can, I caught the tail end of a question that one, the Honorable Ntuli asked on coal. And I'd like to with your permission, really, just deal with that question, Chairperson. South Africa cannot walk away from coal. We can't abandon coal and say that coal plays no role in our future energy needs. The challenge, I think, for us is to recognize coal is cheaper, and coal can be used in part to cross-subsidize the other renewable energies, wind and solar. If we had to abandon all our coal-fired power stations, the cost of electricity would become unaffordable for millions of South Africans. The challenge on the economy would be very, very substantial with such a cost shock to the economy. So we've gone for an organized and systematic process by which we retain our coal base, but a significant portion of the additional energy that we will generate in future comes from renewable sources. Not all of it, but a very significant portion. And we then use cheaper coal to average the price out. But in addition to that, South Africa has to invest in clean coal technologies. There's significant work being done on CCS, carbon capture and storage. The capture part is easy, the storage part is still quite difficult, and companies and countries, as I've indicated, are investing in this area. We've experimented with underground coal gasification, where we essentially try to find ways of using coal, including lower grade coal, in a less carbon intensive manner with a lower carbon footprint. And that project by Eskom is one that we're watching very, very carefully, because it may help us to find new and cleaner ways to use coal. So I think by way of our general approach, it's to say use coal to cross-subsidize, but also invest in technologies to reduce the carbon emission of coal. ESCOM is now looking at the project, a retrofitting of some power stations that can reduce the emissions coming from coal-based energy. So I think, in summary, ultimately, Chairperson, the green economy presents an enormous opportunity. Yes, there are costs to it, but with all these kind of challenges throughout human history, those who are able to invest and take advantage of new needs can find opportunity, investment opportunities, opportunities for commercial return, but also opportunities for jobs. And that's where we're driving our efforts at the moment. We think that we are well positioned, but we recognize we've got to have tighter coordination and much more focused delivery. I point to China's example. A number of years ago, China had very limited technological capacity on green energy. Today, it's the leading producer of components on both solar energy and wind energy, because it's invested very, very heavily in R&D, in manufacturing platforms that reduce the price of component manufacture. And it has now secured a significant employment base for itself. So we come into the process when countries are across the world investing in this area, so there are many competitors, and so we will have to move with significant speed if we are to grab these opportunities. I hope the committee has become persuaded that what we're doing on the solar water geysers is helpful, that there are significant localization opportunities that we've identified. We've basically taken the two different platforms of solar water geysers and pull them apart, and we're looking now at each component, from the flat panels to the tubes to the storage tanks, or what you call the geyser at home, to the connex valve. Each of these are now being examined to see, can we localize in our program, and can we identify opportunities to export. So it is a exciting opportunity for the economy, much as it's one that we have to be frank and recognize does come with some cost pressures. And so government's program is to focus on these three areas that's been highlighted in the presentation, but at the same time we have a number of other projects and programs running alongside these that seek to tap into green energy. So Chairperson, I know that I've not heard most of the questions, but perhaps if there's any that the team want to lob to me, they should feel free to do so. Thank you.
Thanks, Minister. I'm looking at our time. But just to brief you on what really the focus of the meeting actually was more on the low pressure system in as far as the geyser system is concerned. There were concerns around actually, it was commendable that there are projects and programs in place that are beginning to address the challenges that we have. But we still have challenges around effective coordination, effective communication, challenges around lack of uniformity in implementing these projects and programs. The programs and projects have good intentions, but they still lack targets, for instance, clear targets and time frames. Where there are time frames, I think it will be important that certain things get clarified. Also, around the low pressure system, there was a concern around few role players, for instance, that the IDC is funding, especially in relation to installers and so forth, and they're still in terms of production, no local content, and I think you spoke to that now, even the DG alluded to that through the team, they are looking into those issues. I think this is the discussion among the social partners towards the accord, the finalization of the accord, I think. that will actually assist us a lot, but there was a concern around that. And the challenge is that the way IDC continues has a potential of promoting monopolies.
Yeah.
It has that potential of perpetuating that. The business, we don't have any regulation from government in terms of, in as far as even between the high pressure system. Actually, it's within the high pressure system, if members can recall well, if I'm representing you well. And also, in terms of incentives, for instance, there are varied incentives for consumers. This is according to the responses, it's implemented according to how municipalities, you know, see, or it's implemented according to a particular municipality's view, which is to us, it's not something that is that should be encouraged, because we are one state and programs must be the same, whether you are at a national or at a local level. I think these are some of the things. They are not all, but these are some of the issues that we the committee, you know, focused on. And I think we did get responses, but some of the responses were, in detailed discussions, we were promised that we're going to be getting those. Just as a way of illustration, IDC has only three companies in their list in terms of the distributors or the distributors of the low pressure solar heaters, which is something, and that in that you include also a company that is working as an intermediary, and what happened beyond the intermediary you cannot, for instance, in as far as the answer is concerned. While it is said that it's being monitored, but from the experience it's quite clear that there could be loopholes there. In terms of identification, in terms of ensuring that there is transformation, there's development, in terms of getting new role players being roped into the system and so forth. I think those were the issues. The issues around mentoring and coaching and of new emerging entrepreneurs that might also have a future role in this also came up. This was just a hint, Minister, on issues of concern. We also took cognizance of the fact that the department is playing a coordinating role. With IDC as the funder or financier, but we also feel that we can use certain conditionalities to enforce certain things. And as a coordinating department, it is important that we use that lever to ensure that things happen. We've agreed, therefore, that in that role that you're playing, we're going to be ensuring that we get feedback from your side in a, that is a progress report from time to time, because we feel these are very important issues, and hence they required a special meeting like this so that they can be able, or dedicated meeting, not a special meeting, so it's a full-fledged meeting of the committee, but we required a full meeting so that we can focus on this green economy. This shows how important this is. And these were the issues that were raised, just to inform you of what happened. But the DG can continue with the questions, response to questions, and perhaps allow you after the DG to come in. And if members, we still have a few minutes. And if members still have anything to say, you will be allowed after the minister to ask the question. Thank you. Did you?
Thanks, Chairperson. I think it's largely covered, but there was a point raised by the Honourable Singh when he sort of compared the situation in some countries where you get your bottles collected at a certain point, your plastics, your paper, and so on. And I think there again, it is a question of social mobilization, and hopefully this will be one of the key outcomes of the Green Economy Accord, which we anticipate signing shortly. We have held bilaterals with the community constituency where we've looked at opportunities in the social economy for recycling projects and waste management and the potential for cooperatives at community level to play a critical role in that. So I think that is part of the answer, at least to the question that you've put forward, is in the area of social mobilization, which we are addressing through the New Growth Path social dialogue process, and, as I say, the imminent signing of the Green Economy Accord. And then maybe just for me, for Tetsi, to emphasize that the contracting model that we're putting together for the mass rollout of low-pressure systems is where we are going to set targets on local production, on youth employment, and through that actual contracting process, the awards of those contracts will be made on specific commitments that will be made in these particular areas. So that is the model which we are currently putting together. We are really, it's work in progress, but as I've indicated, all the key role players are on board and supportive of this work, which will even bear further fruits during the week we're in now, where some of the key players, including Eskom in particular, has committed to really modeling the scenario that we can achieve. And, you know, as we've indicated, and these are actually Eskom figures that I quoted in terms of, you know, on the targeting side, we're looking at a balance going into the next financial year of around 800,000 systems, which on the basis of a linear progression would be 22,000 systems per month, 17,000 low pressure and 5,000 high pressure. But I think the more likely scenario is that rather than a linear progression, we would have a rising curve in terms of the actual rollout, partly driven by funding, but also through the development of the necessary capacity to do this on the kind of scale that we're looking at. Thank you.
Thank you, Titi. I don't know whether Venture has anything to say.
Okay, if I may just add to the question related to carbon credits. I think to a certain extent carbon credit is a misnomer. And to many people, it's been sold on the basis that you can make a quick buck, which is not the case. I think what we've experienced is that it's a long process, it's a costly process. If you don't understand the different building blocks of getting it to the UNFCCC and getting your project registered, it may happen that you can spend a lot of money and not at the end of the day see any revenue coming from the carbon process. What we've done on the one low-pressure rollout system, we got the project to registration in 8-9 months, which was quite a record time. However, there was quite a bit of cost involved, which was dealt with through the company that we funded. One of the initiatives that IDC is currently undertaking, and there was a public hearing 2 weeks ago, is we participating with two players to develop a programmatic CDM where we can have solar water heaters together with heat pumps at one program. So what we do, we can bring in a number of projects under one program, and we will basically fund the cost of developing that program through a project vehicle. That was in the papers 2 weeks ago, and the hearing was at the IDC, and surely if you need more information on that, you can contact us. But I think it's very important to note that it is an opportunity to get revenue into the project, but you need to follow the right process. And it's not just straightforward. You need to have an emission reduction purchase agreement signed by a company or an off-taker at the right price in order to make sure that you've got a sustainable project. Thank you, Chair.
Minister?
Madam Chair, can I ask one question to the Minister?
I said after the Minister.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Given the focus of the committee at today's discussion on solar water geysers, I think it may be worth just sharing some ideas on how we see this going forward. Not the technical questions, and I'm sure the team has answered. But in looking at solar water geysers, the first thing we recognize is we're building a market for something that didn't really exist on scale in the past. And when one builds a market like this, you need critical mass. You need the kind of level of acceptance of solar water heating systems and an annual uptake that can support localization efforts. If the market, for example, was, let's say, 50,000 a year, then we can produce all of the components locally. There's no technological bar. But the cost of production would be very, very significant because you're producing a small number of units of a large capital outlay. So part of a program like this is simultaneously building the demand side, the market, whilst getting your supply side right, improving your technologies, bringing down the cost of production, working out smartly where you can localize, which are the opportunities for localization where the price gaps are smallest, and building on those. So what have we done over this period? You know, 5 years ago or so, the market for solar water heating systems was a tiny niche market. It was really middle-income consumers who were green conscious, who were prepared to make the very substantial capital outlay for solar water heating systems. But the first step we did with the new incentive that was introduced via ESCOM off the energy or the electricity tariff was to test the market to see can we get acceptance by consumers of these units, because that's fundamental. These are, you know, we're not in a society where the state can just prescribe what happens. You've got to build support for these things. So part one is testing the market. From there, as we test the market, we've got to get the economics and the costing right. So we looked at different models, and I'm sure that the team may have shared with you the vast range of prices between your low-pressure basic unit with a small tank capacity to your very sophisticated advanced models that have dual solar and normal grid energy that it can tap into, and with the, you know, vast water storage capacity. And then step by step, we're now localizing, and we're localizing off a growing market. Now, what the state can do is important. A million units by 2014-15 is not unimportant, but it's not sufficient to sustain that market. You've got to complement it by what you can get from private sector initiatives. So we've looked at the private sector market, and you know, the number of diseases we are told by the industry that burst annually is about 200,000. And that's a very significant potential market because many of those geyser units are insured and the insurance companies pay for the replacement. So part of our dialogue now is with the insurance industry to work out ways of encouraging them to mandate that replacement geysers must be solar water geysers. If we can do that successfully in a partnership, you've got a very significant annual replacement market over and above the market we're creating through the incentive, particularly on you know, so-called RDP housing and so on. And as those volumes rise, that's where the opportunity for real localization comes in. So I know in an ideal world, one would want to, the day you switch on a new program, you'd want to have it 100% localized. But you've got to weave in the economics of it. You've got to make sure that it's sustainable and that you can bring prices down, and that can only happen when you have the kind of volumes that we're trying to create for this market. So I think what we recognize as the state is, as we create that market, there are more opportunities for localization. So I think it's a positive story. You know, one can either look at the fact that some components are still imported, or one can say we actually are now producing locally components for solar water heating systems that we were not capable of doing, or that we did not do 5 years ago. I think that's very significant progress. And what I hope we can do on a regular basis is come to the committee and show you, we hope, successes in increasing the localization level. So I've taken a bit of time just to share with the committee the process by which we think we build this market and increase the localization capability that comes in here. I should also say that we appreciate the advice to the IDC to see the green economy as one where more entrants can come in, both on the manufacturing side, but also on the installation side. And this is an area that we've looked at in the Green Economy Accord, which once it's finalized, will be publicly released, and there will be some indication there of how we think we can do that. So they all are ultimately the function of growing this market aggressively and strongly, and then bringing in new players. We sat down, for example, with the labor movement in the social dialogue, and they said to us, what about cooperatives? And we said, excellent idea. Set up a social enterprise, drawing in retrenched workers, and sponsor it as a trade union. Support it, give it the necessary know-how, talk to government departments about support and incentives that can be accessed, but drive this as a trade union movement or as a community organization, because this can't be a top-down process where the state decides everything, sets up all the enterprises. That takes enterprise out of the development. Enterprise is precisely that local initiative, young persons and others who want to come into the enormous opportunity. So I think we've also raised in the system going forward that we must make opportunity for new entrants to the green economy. You know, in 1994, when the democratic transition happened, we inherited a structure in the economy, in mining, in agriculture, in manufacturing, and so on. And we've had to work with that system and gradually transform. With the green economy, it's completely new. So there is an opportunity here to ensure that we get it right. And so the advice that you're offering is certainly one that you will find us strongly supporting. On the high-pressure systems, even though they're more expensive, they're attractive to us also because they create significant opportunities for taking pressure off the electricity grid. But with a low-pressure system, there's an enormous development dividend. There are many households who previously had no hot running water who now can access it through the solar water geysers. And I don't know if we used some of the pictures just to show. You just need to drive in the Eastern Cape between Port Elizabeth and Uitenhage, and you'll see township after township with examples of ordinary households, South Africans, who are able to access hot water now through these renewable technologies. So I'd like us to celebrate it and be very positive and upbeat about it, because this is a very good success story. 140,000 units, 100,000 of them to low-income households. When I gave these figures to one of my colleagues from a European country, who in his case is responsible for climate change, he was quite taken aback at our success. And so I think as we improve this and we look at the detail, we shouldn't lose sight of the big picture. It's a fantastic story. It's really a good South African success story. And there is scope for further improvement and making the successes even more. On the carbon credits issue, the colleagues have dealt with the technical issues. But I'd like us to encourage South Africans to embrace tree planting and all the other measures as necessary, not because of the rand or two that can be made on carbon credits, but because it's an investment in our own future. You know, if we can make this climate change issue a real issue for South Africans, it's not about some, you know, big story out there that affects others, that it's going to fundamentally change our lives and our livelihood unless we take action now. And that the real energy will come if we can let fellow South Africans see that when they plant a tree, they're investing in their own future, not that it should only be driven by the potential economic rewards that can come in. Obviously, that's also part of it. But the big one is that we need to take action if we are to create an earth that's habitable for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for the responses. Mr. Singh.
Chairperson, thank you.
Mare, Meso Tetsi, Babuntuli.
Chairperson, thank you. I'm very mindful of time, but that I'll ask this minister, the minister, this question, and also to say that, you know, we are encouraged by the fact that the Department of Economic Development is one of the drivers of the green economy. But the question to you, Chair, to the Honourable Minister, is striking the balance between economic development and responsible environmental production processes. And I'm saying this in the context of, you mentioned 1994 just now, and we know pre-1994 maybe planning was not as prominent as it is now. You have had industry situated next to residential places and things like that, and more especially the poor people were situated right next to the industry. Now, a case in point is the Durban South Industrial Basin, which has been something from 1994, I think Honorable President Mandela, many ministers went there. I got Minister Vali Musa to come down there. The incidence of leukemia in that area, of the number of children that have died, is far exceeds anywhere else in the country or even in the world. Now, there is a clash between the residents and the refinery that is there, to such an extent that when the MEC last week issued a notice to the refinery, I won't mention the name, to the refinery to make sure that they are responsible in the way they produce the fuel or whatever product they produce, I mean, they threatened to shut that refinery down. Now, how does one deal with this? Because on the one hand, we know there are a number of jobs, we need the fuel, but on the other hand, we can't allow industry just willy-nilly to continue on its production processes, not adhering to proper standards that are international, that can be internationally benchmarked. So I would just like to know from the side of your department, how would one deal with this balancing, economic development vis-a-vis environmental sustainability and responsibility? And I would really urge, through you, Chairperson, that the Minister intervenes and interacts with authorities in KwaZulu-Natal in particular, with COP17 taking place in Durban. I can bet my bottom dollar, and I don't have many dollars, that there is going to be some kind of protest, strikes, or highlighting of the situation in the Durban South Basin by groups that have a legitimate reason to complain. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Samare.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister. I think, you know, as I've said to the DG, this is quite an exciting, initiative and the whole drive on the green economy. This is a long-term investment, a good investment. So something that I think everybody in South Africa should support. You have referred to, in one of your remarks, about cleaner electricity as well, especially in the rural areas. Now, obviously, you know, I mean, clean electricity sounds that why don't we use alternative electricity, like from the solar panels? Is that a possibility? Is that something that you are thinking of, or the committee or the strategy is looking at? I know it might be relatively expensive, but isn't there a possibility that you can link that to the same panel? Because obviously that will give the benefit to rural areas
where you don't have electricity supply, that this can be an alternative to that. It is also green, clean, you know, there's no carbon emissions. Then the mention that you've made about the insurance companies, I mean, that is exciting. That is now a partnership, I think, in the future. So if they, and I mean, this is something new that I've heard, and something exciting that I've heard. So if there is this commitment from both government and insurance companies, that when they replace ordinary electricity, heating cylinders, geysers, that they will replace that with solar heaters. I mean, that might be a fantastic way of partnering, you know, in the best way. How far is that developed, and or is it just an idea? Because obviously it means that there can be quite an effect for insurance companies, or whether they just increase the premiums, is it conditions that they will bring in? Because certainly, I mean, they are also just for one thing in business, that's for making profits. So if the cost of replacing a geyser is higher than the ordinary one, then they would want to recover that cost from somewhere. The last thing is something that I also asked the DG, and that is the response from, or uneven response from municipalities in terms of some have got the capacity, some not, but also provinces. And we know that some provinces are performing better or worse than others. And you can't expect a municipality to respond if a province, you know, the minister of local government, the minister, you know, various ministers in that, or ministries in that provinces, that should part with you in this way.
Okay.
Housing, for instance.
Mr. Mare, to
what extent? I'm closing down.
Please.
Have you dealt with that, and how will that be dealing with into the future?
Thank you.
That's certainly a bottleneck.
Minister, in our future plans, is there a possibility to ensure that the development of human settlements move almost parallel to the installation of solar heaters? One is thinking of unintended consequences, whereby the development of human settlements could move faster than the installation of the solar heaters. And asking again as a layperson, you know, when we started with the electrification of housing in our township, we were told that even the sacks will be electrified. And it was unbelievable, but it did happen. We have sacks that are electrified. Could it be the same with the solar heaters?
Thank you.
The chairperson. I did not get a satisfactory answer about the protest in Ebusile. We have said there is a protest there where people were complaining about Eskom, and then they were chosen to say Eskom, I mean, with the using of coal, it must end. Now I was asking, what will be the response now for that protest? The other thing was, I'm thinking now the competition with Eskom and this green energy. If you say Eskom now is scaling down to say no, we want 1,000 per month or whatever. Now I'm looking at is Eskom not a competitor of this green energy, because Eskom is using coal. Now, if Eskom comes and dictates what the green energy must do, is it what is that? Are they competitors, or Eskom is also coming in to use the green energy? Lastly, Chair, I ask the capacity building. We said for the small entrepreneurs,
we have a fund, or some of the projects do have a fund to give capacity to these smaller enterprises. Now I was checking with these solar thing. Don't we have any capacity building fund for these smaller companies to come in or to be given a capacity to be on par? Thank you.
Thank you, Mahumduli. Dr. Ram.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Minister, you referred to the Inga project in the Congo River. In 2006, I served on the Portfolio Committee of Public Enterprises, and Eskom briefed this particular committee regarding the Inga project, the hydroelectrical project in the Congo River. And apparently, what they said there, that the World Bank was prepared to fund this particular venture. Has anything happened further than that? Because I think that is the... the Congo River, they said it's the second largest river in the world. It's the only bigger river is the Amazon. Then it's the and apparently that could be an answer to all our carbon, to our energy needs in this country. I don't know. How far is this particular project, and when will... is it still being investigated, or will it happen in my lifetime? I don't know whether it's a pipe dream or whether it's a viable option. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Rabi. Just a few from my first minister. I think I will also add on the question by the whip around, you know, Eskom curbing competition between itself and those who are installing solar heaters, geysers, using the rebate system. I think you can't limit. I mean, they're saying they can supply, but then Eskom says it's too much because they cannot, for instance, keep up with the rebate. I think that is another issue that perhaps needs to be looked at. And then the other issues around the solar geysers, Minister, is around the fact that somewhere in 2006-07, when this green economy issues, you know, cropped up, there was an agreement between national and provinces and municipalities to identify or to give information as to how are they going to assist in, that is the national government, in rolling out the geyser system. Then it was the geyser system, including the generator system, I think, what is it called? Yeah, the generator, yeah, to minimize the usage of electricity. And different municipalities had also to report around issues related to the very same incentives, incentives as to how are they going to compensate or to incentivize consumers who, for instance, opt for such energy saving devices. And I'm not sure whether we have started afresh or we've incorporated that which was there in order to follow up on what municipalities were doing before. Or are these the issues that are within the steering committee dealing with this issue? So that we can see that we're progressing, because I believe there's a lot of information out there. It might have been abandoned, not used, but these are some of the information that can assist in following up some of these issues that do not have answers. I was also concerned about the issue that was raised by Mr. Maria around the insurance company, because there are those who do not have insurances. How are they going to ensure that they are covered? But to those with insurance, are they really going to be paying high their premiums now because of the conversion from electricity to solar heating system. Minister, can we give you this as to respond and also to give your final words? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start with the issue that the Honourable Singh has raised, which is balancing what Honourable Singh calls economic development imperatives with environmental responsibilities. And the question, I think, is how do we achieve that? Now, I would take Honourable Singh back to my opening remark. The way to do it, there's no single magic to it, but it's in working through the details. Number one, on coal, how do we ensure cleaner coal? If we get cleaner coal, we find a better balance between the economic and the environmental. Number two, using the existing coal base, coal is a very cheap generator of electricity on a comparable basis relative to other technologies. How can we use the savings, if you like, on coal to help subsidize the entry into the market of renewable energy? And we do that now. At the moment, you will know that a portion of the electricity bill that Parliament pays, and I hope Parliament does pay its bill, but a portion of that money that is being consumed right now as we're sitting here using the energy goes towards the solar water geyser project. So we're using effectively a cross-subsidization model. But those are the immediate answers. I think there's a more profound point that the green economy also has a commercial and economic logic. And that as we shift over time with all the costs and challenges that come through any fundamental shift that economies go through, you can find in the green economy opportunities for both economic growth as well as environmental sustainability. There are many examples of them. The examples of the catalytic converters that are used in cars. There are examples of the biofuel industry, which as we get it off the ground will create large numbers of jobs in rural areas, providing livelihood to the poorest in the society and at the same time positively contributing to climate change. So it's in each of these weighing up and moving forward based on the cost-benefit analysis, which in a particular instance, can we get the economics of the biofuel project right? Do we need to bring in a little bit of a subsidy to stimulate it at the start, as Brazil has done? Those are the kind of ways in which we think we can find the appropriate balance. I think if one really thinks long term, one shouldn't see a trade-off between the economic and the environment. It's true that there are costs, and you know we've got to be frank and open about it, because when you account properly for those costs, you can deal with them. But in the long run, not only is it environmentally necessary to go green, but there will be major opportunities for jobs and commercial enterprises. And that's the part that we've got to grab and develop for South Africa. Honorable Marie, on the three questions that you've raised. The first question is whether we are open to using solar technologies, including household solar technologies, to generate energy outside the grid and energy in rural areas. And the answer is absolutely yes. There's been some very interesting things happening in European countries with the development of technologies that go beyond just solar water heaters, that seeks to convert sunlight to a more usable energy for cooking and for other purposes. We're watching the technologies, and as they mature, they will provide an enormous opportunity for electrifying villages and rural areas without the need to fully utilize the industrial and commercial grid. But right now, the opportunity lies in the solar water geyser area, and that's why we're pursuing it. That's where the technologies have matured sufficiently for us to feel we can really run on scale with those. On the insurance companies, we're still finalizing the terms. They're imminent. We think we would be able to make an announcement as soon as these discussions are concluded, and we hope this side of COP 17, and so I'd if you'd allow me not to go into all the detail, but it genuinely is about the partnership in which insurance companies take the long view, and they recognize that by bringing scale to the market, they can also help to bring prices down. So this is not a zero-sum game where prices are fixed. Prices are an outcome of quite dynamic things in any economy, and scale obviously is one of it. On the uneven responses across provinces, more than one honorable member raised the issue. I think it was very useful for us to reflect on our experience. We went, and I think the chairperson also raised the question of the delivery mechanism. We went very much with a bottom-up approach, one in which entrepreneurs and local municipalities led the process of applying for these grants that Eskom was making available and rolling out solar water geysers. Now, there's something good to be said for it. But one of the unintended outcomes is that where you don't have that local entrepreneurship or capacity, you underservice South Africans in those parts of the country. The last I looked at it, and I can't recall the exact detail, but the Eastern Cape was by far the leading province on installation, with probably more than 25,000 units out of the 140,000 units installed in the Eastern Cape. Limpopo was on the other extreme with about 400 or so units that were installed. Now, that's a very vast gap between them. And so we are now reviewing the implementation model, the delivery model, so that we have more balanced outcomes. You'll never have it an absolute, you know, to the single unit. But we've got to be able to offer assurance to South Africans who live in Northwest, Limpopo, Northern Cape, wherever they may be underservicing, and assure them that our delivery model will begin to address that challenge. And so when Economic Development Department asked for the provincial breakdown a few months ago, we all studied it very carefully, and I took this issue then to Cabinet as a specific focus, that we've got to rebalance so that we cover more provinces and more people. The Honorable Tsetse has raised a good planning point, which is that under our current model, solar water heating systems by and large play catch up with human settlement building programs. So generally speaking, you have the build program on housing followed by the installation program. As we get the numbers right, and I want to just make one remark on getting the numbers right, we can begin to integrate these. Now, the numbers point that I want to raise comes to the question that the Honorable Mthuli and the chairperson has raised around Eskom. And I want to start by saying that one of the reasons why I think we can celebrate the success of the solar water heating installation program is a few years ago, there was a lot of talk about 1 million units, but very little action on the ground. Subsequently, the takeoff has been very significant, and it exceeded our expectations. In this financial year that we're in right now, we have exhausted the money that was originally set aside for solar water heaters, because the uptake was higher than was estimated. In other words, it was success. It was a good story. And Eskom worked very closely with us to identify sources of funding to bring additional money to play in order not to interrupt the installation program. So our experience has been a positive experience with Eskom. I think it's in part because they recognize that solar water heating systems, even though they can contribute to reducing the load on the grid, are not going to be anything close to the kind of volumes that they generate. I think they also recognize that the relief on the grid for them makes the management of the available resources easier. And I think they also recognize that there is a requirement from their shareholder, namely government, that there be rapid electrification of rural areas, and solar water heating systems provide an opportunity to do one part of it. So for all and any of these reasons, we have found Eskom to be very positive about the solar water heating system, and it's not acted in a manner that gives us any concern that it may see this technology as competing with its coal generating or any of its current generating capacities. I think the vision that Eskom has is a vision in which they can also have a portion of their energy generation via Eskom coming from green sources. But we've also seen that there's an opportunity to bring in IPPs, independent power producers, because very often they have access to new technologies, they bring the entrepreneurial energy. These renewable energies have got one other interesting characteristic. You know, when you set up a coal-fired power station, it's an absolute mega project requiring, you know, enormous sums, billions and billions. And it's a marvel of engineering. If you go to any of these massive power stations, if you go to Medupi or you go to Kusile, renewable energy can be produced on much smaller scale. And that opens the road for many more players to enter the energy market, which has some advantages to us down the line. If I go to the question about complaints and protests that may be taking place about the use of coal, I think the answer we're giving is, obviously I'm not going to deal with a specific incident, because there are no doubt colleagues in the public sector dealing with a particular one. But going with a general approach, we can't abandon coal. We can't walk away from our coal. We've got quite significant reserves of coal, and coal contributes to the relatively cheaper price of electricity that we have compared to a future without coal. And so while we would want to constantly hear the concerns of environmentalists, we've got to be very open to hearing the arguments, and while we recognize that the pressure that they place on governments and on corporations to go green is a positive one, at the same time, we have an ultimate responsibility to balance these things and to ensure that we also produce energy at a price that can fuel economic growth and economic development. The idea of a capacity building fund for smaller players is something that the IDC, I think, must continue to embrace. It's entering a space in its mandate now where we're saying to it, it's not just the big mega projects that the IDC must do. Neither is it simply funding share ownership from white South Africans to black South Africans. That it must embrace the opportunity of bringing smaller players and new players into markets that didn't exist. The green energy one is an important one. It's not the only one. There will be other opportunities with mineral beneficiation down the line and so on. And so I think it must begin to invest, and part of the merger of small business entities is to see how we can build capacity, not a passive recipient of business plans, and then you look at it and if it's not good, you chuck it out, but a more interactive, supportive arrangement. It is, by the way, a development finance institution in which it assists to convert good ideas to good business plans. If the idea is inherently bad and it's got no commercial capability, then of course no amount of writing up of a business plan is going to help. But if it's an inherently good one and it's a capacity problem to capture it in a proper structure, then that's where I think the DFIs can and should be playing a bigger role. On the Honourable Rabi's question on Inga, the good news, Honourable Rabi, is during your lifetime, a portion of Inga has happened already. We've had the development of Inga 1, but what we're looking at is Grand Inga. Is, in other words, Inga on a scale that can produce. Now, let me recognize there are complexities. There are technical complexities. There are political challenges that would have to be dealt with in any multinational project of its nature, because energy will be generated in one country, But the Congo would never be able to utilize all of that energy that's generated for many, many years. So it would have to be used by neighboring countries. All of this requires diplomacy. It means agreements between governments and so on. And I think there are some very positive signs of a of coordination and openness there. Now, what makes Inga so interesting as a river is its geography. You know, at one point the Inga River is very, very wide, and then it very rapidly narrows, and the pressure of that water creates condition for the production of hydro energy on a scale that is truly substantial. If we can tap all of Grand Inga, we would be creating energy that in on paper is equivalent to South Africa's entire current energy generating capacity. You take all our power stations, coal and nuclear together, then Inga, at least on paper, can produce that quantity of energy annually. Now, I say on paper because there are a number of engineering challenges that would have to be met, including transmission challenges, because you'd be generating it in one part of the continent and you'd have to move it to other parts, and there's obviously some loss of energy in the transmission process. So those are the technological issues that would have to be dealt with. And we are quietly confident that there is scope and openness in Southern Africa to really develop Inga, and hopefully at one point in your life you'd be able to make a cup of tea using the energy coming from Grand Inga. Chairperson, if I go finally to what you've raised, I think I've covered the question of the Eskom question in part, but I by recognizing that Eskom has actually worked cooperatively with us on the rebate system, and it's been a good story. But I also would want to say that we have used the municipal-driven and local-driven model around solar water heating system rollouts. And we now need to look at complementing that system with some changes so that we don't have the inequitable outcomes that I referred to earlier with this example of the Eastern Cape and Limpopo. So I think we may need to review some of these agreements and arrangements to make sure that there's a stronger capacity at national level to ensure reasonably equitable outcomes in these things. Thank you very much for the questions that were put to me. I think I've covered all of them. My closing comment, simply, Chairperson, is that all over the world, countries are embracing the green economy. And because it's new technologies, it comes with risks and it comes with challenges. Not every project that we will support will be successful. That's the nature of new technologies, that there are risks. And those risks come because there are different technology platforms. People are coming with newer and smarter ideas by the day. And if you recall, in the old days, the battle between VHS and Betamax, two competing video technologies. Now you see that replicated on scale in the green economy, because smart people are seeing opportunity in this area and they're coming with new things. So which platform you back is important. What will happen in the next few years with that platform is important. This is a cash hungry sector because it's new, because it has so much potential. So we've got to be able to see what we back and what we don't back. And this is a sector where countries as diverse as Spain, the United States, Denmark, China, Brazil, all are trying to get a significant presence, not only in the generating side, but also in the component manufacturing side. So we're going into a contested market, not a market that is open completely just at our disposal. But I remain confident that with work and with focus, with the mandate we've given the IDC as a green industrializer, we've said to it that that's the role we see it playing in future. It's one of the big legacies it can leave future generations. One of the past legacies from the IDC is CESOL, a world-class technology that was developed using IDC funding in part. In future years, we hope our successes in the green economy could similarly be ascribed to the work that ESCOM, IDC, private sector players, government departments and others do in partnership. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. We can go up to 1 o'clock. I think that's the allowance we normally get. Yes. Nikateli, yes, but the information is very important. I was trying to address the issue, the fact that we are beyond our first 12. Minister, thank you very much. DG and the ICC, thank you very much for responding to the committee's call to address it on the green economy. Just one last question. The lifespan of this solar water geysers that we are currently installing through IDC?
Okay, currently the lifespan is beyond 5 years. The current norm in the market is that it's about 5 years, but with a solar water heater you can go up to 10 years in some cases.
Okay.
I think my response earlier was more related to the big wind projects and solar park type of projects.
Okay. Minister, also issues of maintenance were raised. I think it's very important because we don't want to leave the communities with the burden of having to, especially the poorest ones. We are, the meeting is still on. We agreed on increasing communication and awareness on this process. This is a very important one. Communities need to know so that they don't focus on incentives more than, you know, the good of the project, especially with respect to future generations or the benefits it has for future generations. Really, the relationship that you're saying the government has between with ESCOM, I think and I hope that it's not going to bring that imbalance in terms of your target and that which is regulated by ESCOM through this rebate system that it's using. But otherwise, thank you very much, Minister, for the briefing, and we hope that the accord, the Green Economy Accord, will be signed very soon. We want to congratulate you officially on the two accords that you've already signed, that is the Skills Accord and the Local Procurement Accord, and this is quite good work in the good direction. I think together with the social partners, we're doing a great job. Thank you very much for that. And this shows that there is improvement with regards to the implementation of the National Growth Path. With that note, may I also thank the colleagues, members, and perhaps inform you that we still haven't received any response from the speaker around the planned overseas trip. As I briefed you last week, I think we are still waiting for that. But there is, I've seen a note now that there's a meeting that the House Chair is requesting today at 5, so around the trip. I don't know what he's going to be saying. So you will be briefed as and when I get the final response. Otherwise, thank you very much, and the meeting stands adjourned.
How are you? I'm well. How are you doing?
No,
I believe you're doing so well.
Yeah.
Can you see this out?
No, not.
I was.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no. No, don't be sorry. Just be happy. I want to find the top of the CEO of the banking assembly. And we might be